is reward according to Ramban is where you where God affects the laws of nature, but Olam Haba is a natural result of the way you live. So therefore, when we talk about punishment, we only find punishment in this world. We're talking both on the individual and the national level. I'd like to start with a question today, and that is the question is, why is it by Mishlei that they Mishlei is based on two principles. One principle is that you should know the consequences of your actions, and then two, to evaluate the act versus the consequences, whether you should do it or not. Now, just tell me these two ideas. Mishlei goes into great detail, again and again and again, goes over it. And the same thing with the Psalms with Tehillim. They also, each chapter has an idea, and basically there is the prayers and then the different sciences, like how to look at the different sciences, basically. So that's Tehillim. You tell me just these two ideas, and that's it. Why do you have 150 chapters? And sometimes they look so much alike. I mean, it's hard to tell what the difference between one and the other in the Psalms. One is the prayers. They go over King David's prayers. And two, they have like Ashrei, deals with the animal kingdom and how to view the animal kingdom. See, if you look through the reading of Ashrei, it's dealing with the animal kingdom and how to deal with it. It's Psalm 145. All right. The first thing is that there are three reasons why a person doesn't join the mafia. Okay? All right, the first is he's brought up in a moral and ethical home. Okay? And so because that's his personality, so he won't join. He feels guilty if he stole from somebody the way he was raised. Second is, he knows that God gave the Torah, and God said you shouldn't steal and you shouldn't murder. But basically, it's pretty similar. Another authority speaking to him. There's two different authorities. But, okay, one is a little more rational, because you know that God said it, so you should do it. But there is another reason why you shouldn't join the mafia. And that is that Al Capone one time went out of Chicago. He wanted to get away. Wanted to take a vacation from crime. And somebody close to him went with him, and they went to this other city, and they're walking in the street, and the shades, you know, the house was open, it was during the day, and the curtains were drawn, and you could see in. And the guy said, like, it's an amazing thing that people could sit by an open window, and they don't have to worry about being shot and killed. In fact, I read during Al Capone's 7 years that he ruled in Chicago, there were 500 people murdered. Not from him. I mean, he caused some of his people, but all 500, all were from crime. They never bothered anybody else. They only killed each other. They're more afraid of each other than anybody else. Another thing is that Lucky Luciano said that if he went legit, he'd probably make the same amount of money that if he that he did in crime, and he wouldn't have to worry about, you know, being killed and the police and working all these things out. Because what did he do? Because at that time, I mean, Al Capone started it, and then Lucky Luciano, they started organized crime, which means they became CEO of a company. And they had to organize the company. He says if he used his mind to organize a legitimate company, he could have made the same amount of money. So the thing is, the third reason why you don't join the mafia is because it's not a good life. You see? It's not a good life. So therefore, the book of Mishlei, or Musar, the way I understand Musar, is to evaluate. It's a constant evaluation of different aspects of everyday life, and slowly you see through these these evaluations that the life of Torah is the best possible life that the physical world could offer. Okay? And that you slowly change from an authority type of ethics and morals, and once you're working based on authority, then you have guilt, fear, shame, you know, like all these type of emotions. You change that, there's a transition from that to a realistic type of life where your mind sees that the lifestyle of the other type of life other than the Torah life is not the best life that a human being could have. So there's a transitional period. In fact, when you first start learning Mishlei, the reason why you would learn it is because the authority tells you to learn it. And when you see the verses at the beginning when you first start learning, so you see the logic, but the logic fits in to your personality, you see. So therefore, because you hold that this is right, now you see it's logic, so you feel very good. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to slowly undo the authority relationship to Torah, and you change it from an authoritative relationship to a realistic relationship to Torah. And it's the evaluation of the lifestyle of Torah versus all other lifestyles, and that is basically the definition of Musa. In other words, you don't need the authority. The way you make decisions and the way you look at life is not because I need the authority to tell me, but it's because I know personally that, I mean, my mind sees it, that it's simply, it's like, it would be like equal to walking in front of a truck. You know what I mean? Taking poison, leaving the life of Torah. You understand? I mean, I see it so clear. It's not because God told me. It's because I see it. My own mind sees it. Now, the thing is, in the Proverbs, chapter 1, verse 7, it says, the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. And the second half of the verse says, wisdom and musar, fools bazu is to degrade or to put down. Okay? That's what it says. So the thing is that the two sides, one side is the fear of God, and the other side is that the fool disregards or puts down the wisdom and mussar, right? And mussar is the evaluation. And the other side says the fear of God. So therefore, the fear of God must be the evaluation with chachma, with wisdom, and with mussar. This type of evaluation, that's the fear of God, and the fools push it aside, right? So fear of God is to evaluate and see that the other lifestyles, other than what God has, will lead to destruction and will lead to harm. And therefore you're afraid to give in to your emotions that desire the other lifestyle because you see all the consequences and all the destruction in that type of lifestyle, and that is called fear of God. That's the lower level, that's the lower level of relationship to God, is fear of God, and it's a result of the evaluation of the lifestyles, and you become afraid of the consequences of the other lifestyles so that you turn away from it. That's why that is the that's fear of God. The fear of God is the because his system is the best system. Any other system would be harmful to you. I'm not saying that it can't be the God's personal intervention. That's also a fear. You understand? It's part of it. You evaluate that you have to put that in the. In the when you analyze it, that's also a component of analyzing it, that God will punish you, that it will intervene in the laws of nature and punish you. That's also part of the consequences. Okay? So, therefore, you're evaluating that part of it, too. That's also part of the evaluation. I mean, there's different aspects of the evaluation. It's all different aspects of life. Now, the thing is that when you study the different sciences, the sciences gives you a certain humility, okay? In other words, you start realizing that how your feelings are not always in line with reality. In other words, like this, let me give you a example. Years ago, you see, the thing is like this, before we get to that, the people, if you notice children, if they're in the bedroom, so they're afraid of monsters, right? So you put a nightlight there. Then they're afraid that the monster is either under the bed or the closet. So you see, fear is always where you cannot see it. Now, the same thing, fear is also where you cannot understand it. Well, you see a phenomena that you cannot understand, so you have terrible fears, and you start placing monsters and different types of superstition in those areas, you see? But now, as the sciences have grown, and we start seeing the ideas that everything, all the ideas, it's hard to find a place to find these monsters, you see, because everything has a intelligent interpretation. We see how it works according to the system. So the thing is that the laws of nature slowly start taking away from the magic of the world. That's one aspect. Two, if you study the universe, you start realizing what am I, you know what I mean? I'm not saying that you know. Let's say, for instance, you know that that the light year is between 5 and 6 trillion miles. And I think the sun, the closest star to the sun, I think, is 4 light years away. And you're talking over 20 trillion miles. Okay? Like, you can't even imagine it. But let's say you started studying the different galaxies day in, day out, every day you read it. Let's say you read an astronomy book every day for an hour. You would sit down and study astronomy for an hour. Like, after a while, it's only not true only in your mind, but suddenly there's awareness of the unbelievable vastness of the world. Like, see, look, so what can I accomplish? I mean, what's the big deal? Tell me anything in this world that could accomplish anything. So what? So who are you? I mean, you do things. Like even Moshe. Moshe is not, in a sense, great like a hero. He did that which was realistic, you see? He simply did that. God told him that was realistic. It's not a hero. The hero falls apart, you see? You look at a person, he's not a hero, but you see realistically how he lived his life when you start seeing the universe, you see? So therefore, when that starts happening and your personal emotions fall by the wayside, you start sensing that there's a God there. And therefore, you're drawn to the Creator, the one that created this world, you see. The same thing with prayer. What is prayer? Prayer, as a study, is a study of what it will take for me, how must I live my life for God to relate to me? In other words, I want to understand how God relates to humans, in what way, so therefore it's a study of what I must do to get in line with the God's will, so God's hashkafa should work for me, you see? So then when I study these two things, God's system, and I study the hashkacha and God's personal relationship with me, then I study these two things, then I stand in awe of God's systems. He has two systems. One is the laws of nature, and then the system of how he relates to me, and I stand in awe of God. That is in Hebrew, for both of these, for fear and awe, they only have one word. It's called yirah. Yirah Hashem, the fear of God. But the lower level is fear of God, and when we translate the higher level, it's awe of God. you see? So therefore, the reason why we have to review constantly Mishle is to get the fear of God, you see, the way we define fear. And the review of Tillim there is to get me to be in line with God's will so that I am drawn to God, and then I will be under God's hashkacha, God's personal relationship to me. So therefore, I have to constantly review, because both books, the purpose of both books is a transition. One is a transition from the emotional relationship to the physical world and to God. The second is a realistic relationship to the world. The Tillim is to get a relationship, to change from the fear of punishment, where my attachment to God is I want to do it only because it's real, because it's realistic, therefore I do it, even if there were no consequences, or even if I will get consequences. Whatever happens, I don't care. I just want to do the will of God, you see? So therefore, it has nothing to do with I'm afraid that maybe of the consequences. It has nothing to do with consequences. It's a transition in my relationship to God, you see? But I must start off with Mishle to change from the emotional to the realistic. Then once I go to the realistic, then I could relate to God in the realistic. Okay? Now, the thing is, the question is that a lot of people say they fear God. You know, before they learn Mishle, there's a certain fear of God. That fear of God is an emotional relationship to authority. That practically all religions, every religion has that, you see. The thing is that starts us off. It's probably a good reason why God gave human beings a religious emotion. You understand? True, many mistakes come out of the religious emotion, but on the other hand, the religious emotion keeps us in line with Judaism. But Judaism tells us that Judaism tells us that the religious emotion should not make decisions about God, and should not make decisions about how to relate to God. The religious emotion should only tell us to learn Torah, and the Torah will tell us who God is, and the Torah will tell us how to relate to God. And we cannot do that without the Torah. So therefore, we have to control the religious emotion to guide us to learn Torah. Then the Torah tells us how to relate to God. Before you learn Mishle, then you relate to God based on how you feel. I mean, it's a certain feeling that I should relate to God, but it's not the Torah telling you how to relate to God, you see? So therefore, you start out with the religious emotion. Namely, you have authority, and because you have this authority, you have fear and guilt and shame. And then that tells you you should learn Torah, because when you read Torah, it says you should learn Torah. Then you learn Mishle. Mishle starts evaluating. Then when you start evaluating, well, the first step in the logical thing is a proof that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai. You must know that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai. That's the first one. But that doesn't change your emotional relationship to God. That only says that the book is real. But the thing is, what changes your emotional relationship to God, the first step is Mishle. And then the second step is Tillim. The first is fear of God, and the second is awe of God. All right, the question is to differentiate between the fear of God and awe of God. Fear of God is an evaluation of lifestyles, and I see that other lifestyles other than the Torah lifestyles would lead to a terrible life. Like I gave the example before of the mafia. You see the lifestyle of the mafia, you see that it's a horrible life. And that's just one example, but there are many, many other lifestyles. When you go through all the lifestyles, you suddenly find that the best lifestyle to live, the best lifestyle in the physical world is, or the best life that you could live in the physical world, is the life of Torah. That is fear of God. What it means, fear of God, means I'm afraid to not to live his lifestyle because I'll have terrible consequences, which would include God intervening and punishing. But even without God, the lifestyle itself is a good lifestyle. The question is what do we mean by the best lifestyle? There are two things about having the best life. The best life means the avoidance of the gain, to avoid pain, and to have the most pleasure in life. That's the best lifestyle. So when you go away from the ones that give you pain, like if you live the lifestyle of the mafia, like we showed before, that would give you a life of pain and conflict. You see? Conflict is also pain. So therefore, those lifestyles will be conducive to pain and conflict, and so therefore, you don't want that. So what's left is the lifestyle of Torah, and you see the lifestyle of Torah will help you move away from conflict and also to gain the most pleasure with the least amount of pain. The question is that if I make a decision based on the evaluation of what is the best lifestyle, so that's self-serving, right? So it seems to be contrary to a relationship with the God. And it looks like that it is as if that you're using God just to have a good life, okay? That's a good question. The thing is like this, there is the development when we talk about the world of ideas, the world of ideas is a development in my character and in my personality, okay? Now, the thing is that every human being, when he starts out in life, is basically selfish. So therefore, I can only use that selfishness to motivate me. So I have no choice. So the first step is I use the selfishness, but I say that there's two types of selfishness. There's a selfishness that harms me. In other words, let's say I say, well, I don't care what anybody else says, I'm going to go on drugs. You see? So that's fighting authority. But if you would be able to experience the consequences of being on drugs, you would never go on it, you see? So that's what we say. We say that there's two types of selfishness. One is based on the emotions without thought. Then there's a selfishness based on thought, the ideas that you see that this is the best life. So the first transition is to be a chacham. Chacham is a wise person. What's a wise person? The first step in wiseness is what is the best way to be selfish? What is the most intelligent or realistic way of being selfish? That is the book of Mishlei, you see? You cannot now once you're a chacham, you see, and then you study the subjects that Tehillim deal with, then that takes you out of your selfishness and you're drawn to reality itself. And then you're drawn to reality, then you're drawn to the ultimate reality, basically God. That is the development. But when you start out and you feel you're relating to God when you're starting out, that's the emotional relationship that started with some type of authority figure based on your psychological makeup. That is not the Torah view of God's authority, you see? So therefore, like I said before, you must have religion should only tell you one thing, that you should study Torah. But religion should not tell you who God is and how to relate to God. You see? Therefore, we must go according to human nature. So if we go according to human nature, we must first find out the most intelligent way of being selfish. And once we do that, and we have that lifestyle, then we could move to the next step, and that is to be to relate to God via the study and via reality, and God is the ultimate reality. right, once again, awe of God is where I study the universe, or I study the system of how God relates to me, and I learn what I need to relate to God. You see, and I see God's system of how he relates to me. That draws me, that helps me to become a person that's drawn to reality, not because I'm worried about the consequences, but my nature is to be drawn to reality. And once I'm drawn to the reality of the physical world, then I am drawn to the cause, the ultimate reality, that which brought about the physical world, namely God. That's the ultimate reality. And then I'm drawn to that ultimate reality, even when consequences don't affect my life anymore. I mean, that's a very high level. I mean, you could be on the level of Pilum, and in certain situations, you have to go back to the lower level to help you pull through a difficult situation. You understand? Because your emotions are awakened, so you have to go back to the lower level. We can't give it up. But, I mean, ultimately, there's some people, our forefathers, that reached a level where they could probably relate to God totally based on awe of God and his relationship to God, and it has nothing to do with the consequences or not. It's similar to when King David left, when he was running away from his son Absalom, and he was leaving the city, he told the Kohen Gadol, he says, I will be back. In other words, the way he understood what was happening, his interpretation was God was punishing him, but then he will be back. But then he says, and if not, so then okay, then that's God's will. So yeah, then I let God's will be done. That's it. In other words, whether I have a good life or a bad life, it's not the importance. The importance is that I'm drawn to that reality. And that's the ultimate. But the thing is, most people can't live only in that world. So when you move into that world, sometimes to stay in line, you have to move back to the fear of God again to keep you in line in certain situations where the emotions become very powerful, to make sure you don't go off. So you move, when you're on the lower level, so that's the only thing you could do, fear of God. When you're in the awe of God, when you first move into there, so then sometimes you have to move back, and you move back and forth between the fear of God and awe of God. What happens is when you're on the higher level, then a situation occurs, you automatically revert. I don't think you have to spend... because situations are very fast. If you don't revert, you're going to fail, because it's not enough. The higher level is not enough to help you through. So either you're going to revert or fail. So there has to be a natural thing that you're going to revert. It's not a matter of I have to think it through. Most of the time, situation, you don't have time to think through. So it has to be a natural that you revert to the fear of God to help you pull through. Now, in this development, there are three steps. Okay, the first step is that you become a chacham. Chacham is wise. And that is that in your personal life, you know, whether I should join the mafia or not, is because it's not good for my personal life. So it's a very selfish thing. Also, in this level, you can become a tzaddik. Tzaddik is a righteous person, namely, that I see that the best lifestyle is to be just and kind to others, and that is, then I show through evaluation that it is the best lifestyle, so then I become a tzaddik. Okay? So Mishlei will help you become a chacham, and Mishlei will also help you become a tzaddik, that you live the life of wisdom in your personal life, and the life of justice in relationship to others, based on the evaluation. Okay? Now, in his prayers, King David speaks about a chassid, that he is a chassid, not the sect chassid, but certain term that he uses, always chassid. And the word chassid comes from the word chesed, kindness. Okay? Now, the thing is, when you reach that level through the studies and you see all these things, your personal emotions are not important. And as you see they're not important, they fall by the wayside. That's what you're working on through these studies of the different sciences. And as you look at it through the eyes of Tillem, so the personal emotions, like all, practically all emotions, not all, but practically all emotions, are relative to others. Jealousy, competition, stingy, spendthrift. I mean, it's all these things. It's always you're buying, you're selling. There's always other people. If you're living on an island by yourself, you wouldn't have these things. You know what I mean? So therefore, all these relative value systems fall by the wayside, you see, and you're drawn to reality. In other words, your value system is reality, you see, and not these personal things. So therefore, the highest level, I mean, that we're talking about, there are higher levels, but that we're talking about is where you're drawn to reality, and you're not drawn to personal relationships with others, but you're drawn to reality and not the personal relationships. You see? When you reach that level, then King David, many times, he shows, when he argues with God that God should help him, he says these, so he has two arguments. Sometimes he holds these people are evil, like for instance, look, I'm not a tzaddik, but however, I'm not a Nazi, right? So the Nazis are so bad, God, so please, even though I don't deserve help, but the Nazis are so bad, at least get rid of them. That's one type of prayer. But there is another type of prayer that I am a chassid. I am totally in line with reality. My emotions are in line with reality. So because of me, you should turn them away. You see? So therefore, the highest level, which gives you a personal relationship to God, the beginning of the personal relationship to God, is becoming a chassid, where you are in line with reality, and your personal relationships with others are based on chachma. That's all, based on wisdom, but not on a system, or not on a value system based on others. I don't evaluate myself. He has more than me, or I have more than him, or I could beat him, or he could beat me. I don't evaluate it. But that's only when you reach the level of Tillem. So, in other words, I'd just like to give you personal advice. Don't try to give these things up and let it happen. When it comes to a mitzvah, when it comes to doing actions, you should force yourself, even if you don't like it, you're not in the mood, you could force yourself to do an act. But a change in personality, you can't force yourself, but it must come through the study itself. There is a development that the study itself is, you have to let it happen. You can't force it. It's the study itself that causes it to happen. That's why I say the religious emotion should force you to do only one thing, and that is to study Torah. And the Torah itself, the study of Torah, will affect your personality and who you are and how you look at life. I'll try and give an example of the difference between a person living the life of Mishlei, fear of God, and a person living awe of God. Okay? Now, jealousy will tell me to talk Lashon Hara about people. Jealousy will tell me to put people down or to take away things from them, to destroy things that they have that I'm jealous of, right? But Mishlei, when I go through the evaluation, I see that's no good, so I live the life that I don't carry out the harm, even though I have the emotion. Emotionally, I'm still in conflict, but I start living the life of Mishlei, the actions, because the evaluation is there. The person that's a chassid has no problem. He has no problem with the other guy. He has no jealousy. So he only does that which is right. Like, on the contrary, when a person, in other words, if I'm on the lower level and somebody, let's say the mafia guy comes in, has his beautiful homes and he has these stretch limousines and all these things, so I'm jealous of him. Even though I evaluated it, my jealousy is still there, but I'm still not going to live that life because I see that's going to harm me. You see? When I'm a chassid, it doesn't even bother me. I can't imagine that things aren't just worth it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I don't have the emotion. That emotion is gone through my studies. Right, the question is that how do you work on your emotions to turn away from the relative value system? The answer is really it should go at one big swoop when you attach to through the studies of the universe and through the study of prayer, which is God's relationship to me. So it should go away by recognizing these unbelievable ideas, so my emotions are not important, you see. The particular emotion, I'm drawn to the world of ideas, and emotions work on particulars. So particulars are not important to me, so they should disappear. But the problem is sometimes there are certain emotions that stop your development. And those emotions, then you have to deal with the particular emotion. In particular, when the particular emotion is affecting your development. But if there's no particular emotion affecting your development, then you should just work in the world of ideas and study, and that will affect your emotions. Right, the question is, who is in a better situation for this type of work? Younger people or older people, okay? I have found that it is easier for younger people and teenagers than adults. The reason is because when you start going to college, and especially if you get married, there are certain commitments in your mind that you have made, and there is a hurdle that you've passed, and you've accepted that this is your lifestyle. And once you've made that commitment to that lifestyle, to be able to say that that's wrong and to change my lifestyle, that's like Rabbi Akiva, you know what I mean? That's the rarity. But however, a teenager hasn't made a real commitment to life. He hasn't chosen a wife. What type of wife? He hasn't chosen a career, or even if he has, he could still change. He knows that. He recognizes that he needs people to learn from. Many times an adult, the definition of an adult is how a child viewed his parents. Child views his parents like he knows everything, you know, and he's like a god, you know what I mean? And so therefore, when psychologically the child changes to an adult, so it's not through thought, it's a psychological change, then the change is his infantile definition of an adult. I know it, I'm an adult, therefore I know it, and therefore there's nothing more to learn. Therefore you see a lot of adults stop developing. While a teenager recognizes, or a child younger than a teenager recognizes that he needs authority to teach him, and he knows that he has to develop. So he's not committed yet. And therefore, it's easier to make that start. And if you become a chacham at that stage, so then when you make the transition to adult, then the transition is only based on the world of ideas. And you know that your ideas change, and it accepts that also, and it's part of the change that I'm developing, and therefore becomes part of you. But for adults to change, that's a very difficult, plus the situation of an adult is difficult. I mean, if you want to go to a yeshiva, a teenager, parents will support him basically, so he goes to yeshiva, he could learn. Well, the adult, what is he going to do? Walk out on a family? It's not an easy thing. So the situation and the psychological makeup of an adult many times makes it difficult for him to change. So therefore, I hold the change is easier if you start out at a younger age. At an older age, there are people that made it, Rabbi Akiva, that's the most famous one. But there are others that have made the transition, even later on in life, from the emotional way of life and the living life to a realistic way of life. I've seen it in adults. But, however, that's a little harder and a little rarer. In other words, sometimes consciously, an adult wants to change. You see, he thinks about it, he says, I should change, I should get wisdom. But the fight with his emotions that has been set in his lifestyle, where he made decisions about his lifestyle, and he's gone in that direction, makes it much more difficult to deal with than a teenager that has not, that is not committed to a particular, in general, they are committed to a certain amount, but completely committed, they're not committed, and they recognize that they're open to ideas from others, and from and that they will change and develop as they go along. An adult, it becomes much harder. The question is that an adult has more experiences, and should that be better than the education? Let's say an education without these experiences of adulthood, maybe that makes it easier for the adult because of his experiences. The answer is that if you experience something, it's not the experience that helps you develop, how you deal with the experience. Now, if you became an adult based on your emotions, and you deal with experiences based on your emotions, so then the experience is not teaching you anything, but you make sure the experience fits into your emotions, but you're not learning anything from the experience. But if you have the correct training, then you learn how to gain and to develop based on your experiences, how to deal with these experiences. That in itself is a knowledge. So therefore, as you develop, these experiences will help you develop because the way you look at the experience will help you develop. All right, we're in chapter 8 of Psalms, and verse 1. And it says that basically it gives an introduction about the musical instrument. Okay? Anyway, verse 2. God, my master, how mighty is your name in all the land that it gives you majesty over the heavens. Okay? So somehow your name is related to the heavens. In other words, when you see the system of astronomy, right, or physics, so that is where your name will be. And then it says, from the mouth of infants and those that are nursing, you have founded, is the foundation of strength, right? You found the strength against your enemies, to quiet or silence your enemies and to take vengeance against them. Okay? Basically, King David is saying here is that your name is mighty means that if your name is recognized as mighty, when people study the universe and when they study things here on the planet, as simple as nursing, the science, and when you see how it works, the whole thing, how a child is while it's still before it's born, that it's taken care of, all its needs are taken care of via the mother, and how all the needs are taken care of afterwards, how the body is made just for all this, and you see the whole wisdom of it from this angle. So therefore, in other words, there are two ways of looking at God's wisdom. One, you look at the universals, like the physics, the whole system through physics, or even the small particulars that you see in everyday life. There's a tremendous amount of wisdom there, and that you could learn from, and then you will relate to God. So the second half of the verse is saying like this: there are different types of enemies of God. Some enemies of God are against Israel, like they come against Israel, and they don't recognize that Israel is the chosen nation, so we consider them an enemy of God. Over here, the enemy of God are those thinkers that have ideas, and yet they still can, and they see, they're thinking people, and they see the universe, and yet they still can't accept God. So he says, you have created the world, and you have a foundation of strength against your enemies. You know what I mean? And to destroy them, and to quiet them. It says quiet them here. Means quiet means that they can't speak. You understand? But, I mean, of course, these people don't recognize it. Therefore, they still come out against God. Because they have powerful emotions that they don't want to see the truth. But it's frankly impossible to look at the universe. I mean, in all these wisdom from every single angle. That everything, every point is needed. Every point, scientists say, we don't know the reason for the color of a certain insect, which means that they know that it has a purpose. Even the color, everything has purpose. I mean, it's hard to imagine that world like that could come about without a God intervening.
Did you read the last one's comment?
In other words, if you look at the universe and recognize that every single thing has purpose, okay? So therefore, it's impossible to say, in other words, if there was a universe that came about without God, then I would say that, you know, some things might work, some things don't work, they have no reason. You understand? It's just a chance happening. How could it be so perfect, you see? The thing is that makes me realize right. Anybody that does not see this, you're going to have to say that there's some emotion that's stopping them from seeing this reality. We're in chapter 8, verse 4, okay? He says, when I see your name, the actions of your fingers, in other words, and what is that? The moon and the stars that you established, okay? So he says the works of your hand that I under the work, he calls it the works of your finger, that is the universe. Seems to be that's the work of his finger. I don't know why they use the term finger. But anyway, we see God's name. We truly be able to see God through the universe. Okay, that's where we see your name. And through the universe, okay. Then it says, "What is?" But verse 5: What is man that he should be remembered or mentioned? And the Son of Man also, it's just a repeat of that he should be remembered. Okay. In other words, like, why did God give man that he relates to man personally? You know, what is man that he should relate personally? And of course, there's always in the Psalms, you always have to be careful when he suddenly changes subject. Okay? We'll come back to it, but you realize he changed the subject. First, he's talking about the universe and how to see God. So the thing is that that he changed the subject. We'll get back to this. But whenever it is in the Psalms, he changes subjects, you should always be aware to understand why he suddenly changes. Okay? But anyway, he said that what is the human that he should be involved with the human. Then he says in verse 6, he made him a little lower than the angels, and honor and beauty he crowned him. Rashi says he made him a little lower than the angels. In other words, he quotes about Yeshua, the miracles that he controlled the laws of nature, and Moshe, he split the sea, you know, like this control of nature. So he says that that's why he made him a little lower than the angels, the abilities that we have. Okay? And The verse says that he made us a little lower than the angels.
Right.
Right? Now, so Rashi says, what does it mean, lower, a little lower than the angels? That we can control through. I mean, really, it's God that's doing it, but they reach the level that through them, the laws of nature are suspended.
And is that?
Then he continues on with the human. He says, and he is ruler over the works of your hand. In other words, the human rules the works of God's hand. In all places are beneath his feet. The sheep and the oxen, all of them. The reason why he says all of them means all domesticated animals, okay, that are domesticated. Then it says, Vagam, and also the animals of the field, meaning the wild beasts. Of course, we learn how to trap them and to control them, you know what I mean? Like we could put them in zoos, we have control over them. The birds of the heaven and the fish of the sea, we could capture them and those things, right? We pass through the lanes of man passes through the lanes of the oceans. He travels all over the world. Wherever he wants to go, he goes, and he has control over all the things wherever he travels. Then he returns to the original subject, the last verse. And he says, God, my master, how strong is your name in all the land? Okay? So the question is like this. First he talks about the greatness of God and about the universe. Then he talks about that what is man that he should even bother. And then he goes on to show how great man is. I mean, like, he's a little lower than the angels, and he shows how he controls everything, the laws of nature itself. And then it goes into details, the different areas of within nature. In other words, he controls everything within nature, and there are individuals like Moshe and Yeshua that could control, even the laws of nature. That through them, the laws, they control the laws of nature. So you see that man is unbelievably great. So then why is man nothing? You know what I mean? Like, you can't have it both ways. And what does all this have to do with the universe? You know, God's, we know you through the universe. What does that have to do with the universe? You see? There seems to be first of all, there's three different themes. The universe, how low man is, and how great man is. And also, how low man is, how great man is contradictory. Which one is? Is he greater, or is he nothing? Right. Through the universe, when a person sees the universe, so then, King David says, you recognize God's name. You recognize God, and you recognize that the universe is the work of God's hand. It's a metaphor of God's making, right? Now, when you recognize that, then you recognize you yourself in the realm of the universe. You recognize yourself as being an absolute nothing. When you look at God's work, let's just take space without the wisdom of the universe. You understand? Without getting into the wisdom of the different theories of physics, but just the vastness of the universe, that alone, which would be a lower level of humility, okay, of feeling like a nothing. I mean, in other words, it would be that you would be less than a piece of sand in relationship to the beach. You would probably be smaller than that piece of sand compared to the universe, okay? So when you recognize that, then you have to feel like, what am I? What could I accomplish? What could I do? You see? That's the first thing. Just as a side, I would like to explain that, they say the closest star to the sun is 4 light years away. That's over 20 trillion miles. Now, the thing is, I know this, and I could take a test on it, but however, it doesn't, it doesn't affect me. But if you studied astronomy every day for hours, after a while, the magnitude of the universe affects you. In other words, it's not just knowing this or that particular fact, but it's through studying again and again from all different angles the vastness of the universe, then it affects you personally where you feel like you're nothing compared to it. Even more so if you saw the ideas and concepts behind the universe, then even more so you would see God's greatness in comparison to yourself. Okay? So I don't know if King David is just talking about the vastness of the universe. The odds are he's probably talking about the concept of the theory of physics that he had at the time. But when you get through with that, you realize that you absolutely have nothing. But simultaneously, once you recognize that, you also recognize your responsibility in this world. In your responsibility to the world, since you have since you control everything on the planet Earth, your responsibility in the planet Earth is to make sure that things work correctly and add things as it is necessary, or to subtract or to do things as it is absolutely necessary. So simultaneously that you feel like a nothing, but you recognize that you are part of that God made you, and you see the way God made you, even though you can't understand why God should relate to you in this great universe. When you see the universe, and therefore when you see how great God is, especially, let's say, for instance, a person would be a prophet and he deals directly with God, then, I mean, his humility has to be even greater than that. You understand? Like when he recognized who God is by having a direct relationship with him, you see? Up until Moshe, where he felt like an absolute nothing. So therefore, that is a true. We feel like nothing. But simultaneously, that brings us to a strong attachment to God and to do God's will. And to do God's will is we must maintain the physical world as we know it. I'd like to read you something. There was a man by the name of Moshe Chaim Lozzato. He lived around 300 years. He lived before the Vilna Gaon, I guess 200-300 years ago. Anyway, he wrote a book on logic, and in his introduction, he says like this. He says, when you look at the world and what happens to it, all the creatures, you will see that God made man, he gave man a very great portion in the settlement, in settling the world, and in the completion of everything that fills it. Until you're able to say that the creation, when God created the world, that insofar as this is concerned, he only made the beginning, the foundation of all things that he created, but he placed in it a potential of completion. However, the completion practically was given over to man completely. And he says, he quotes our sages that says that you could know the truth of this subject when that all the world needs fixing and completion when you look at the wheat. You know, wheat you can't do anything with. You have to grind it. And that's Rabbi Akiva too. And he quotes Rabbi Akiva here, the story of Rabbi Akiva, which we mentioned many times, where where Rabbi Akiva was talking to this captain of the army, and the captain asked him, what is better, man-made things or God-made things? And he shows them wheat, and he shows them bread, and he says, which is better, man-made things? So you see that the world was given over to man to complete it, you see? And you also find, not only here, but you also find in justice. God gave us a system of justice. There's a Gemara that says that when Moshe died, Yeshua forgot certain laws. They say around 2,000-3,000 laws. So he went to God. I mean, what it means, he forgot it. It means like he didn't know if watch is wearing or carrying. You understand? Like, he knew that you weren't allowed to carry, but there were certain details which he wasn't sure of. The general system he had, but there were certain particulars like he lost. So God says it's not in heaven. The system is not in heaven. I can't give it to you. There's only one transmission to Moshe. And if you want to know what to do with the system, look in the Torah. What does the Torah say? Should set up a Sanhedrin and they'll vote on it. So it's very possible that we're doing actions which God didn't tell us on Mount Sinai, because there's difference of opinions, and then they voted on it, and then we might be doing the opposite. You see, the answer is that there also God gave us a system, and he gave it over into the hands of the man to maintain the system, to make sure that the system is maintained, and the basic foundation of the system was never lost. I mean, that we have to wear tefillin, that tefillin has to be black, that tefillin has to be square, that the tefillin that you put on your head, there are four boxes that have four, there are four compartments that have four different portions, scrolls of the Torah. There's a difference of opinion what the order that you place it in the box, you see? So the thing is, you'll notice, like, for instance, there's no question you're not allowed to make a knot on Shabbos. The question is, what's the definition of a knot? That is a difference of opinion. So you see, the basic foundation is there. The details are sometimes a difference of opinion. And it's given over to the human, that the human should maintain this system of law. So you see that our job in this world is to complete the world. God created incomplete, and complete the world, and then to have a system of justice that God gave the basic foundation, and then we must maintain that system, even though it's not in the particulars, it's not exactly what God gave on Mount Sinai, but it's the system that is maintained, that was given over to the human to maintain it. So therefore, even though when you look at the universe, you see yourself as nothing, simultaneously, when you're drawn to the will of God, you want to do the will of God, and therefore you do what you, God's will is that you should maintain the world. Another point is, if you look at the ecological system, the human being is really not part of the ecological system. The human being has a responsibility to use and maintain the physical world. So therefore, in other words, in the world we have two extremes. We have those people that don't care if people lose jobs as long as we keep the ecology. There are those people that don't care about the ecology as long as we satisfy our greed. You know what I mean? That's two ends. The truth is, we have a responsibility to make sure the ecological system is maintained, but not at expense of humans, but that humans should all have jobs and they should be able to work. So there has to be some type of means that we must keep up, that we must keep up in that way also we must maintain the world through the ecological system. Yeah, in other words, by not only maintaining the physical world, Well, we're improving it. I mean, today we have cars, telephones, I mean, computers, all these different things we have in the world. Medicine, I mean, is an unbelievable change. Yes, definitely we're obligated to complete and finish the world the best we can. The question is how to guide your life, you know, based on these things. How do you know when you're doing it? The answer is that just like in any profession, person must go to learn it, either a trade, so he goes to trade school, or if he wants a profession, then he goes to college, he has to learn. Same thing, we have a book called Torah, which teaches us how to think and how to run our personal lives first, and then to be guided by wisdom, and to how to make distinctions where we should do this and how to make decisions, where we should do something or where we shouldn't do something. Then when we become wise and know how to make decisions, then we'll know how to make decisions about the world also, where ecologically you should take care of the ecological and man does not need this, or in certain areas where man is going too far that we say, no, you don't have to do that. Why do that? We could live without that, without destroying the ecological system. And also what we use of the ecological system we should put back. Like we mentioned, the trees of the trees that people cut down, the trees, and then they replant it, and 15 years later they come back to 15 years later to cut it down again and replant. They have a whole system of doing that. So the thing is, that could be worked out, but it has to be done with wisdom to know exactly where and when. But the training must come from. The must come from learning how to make decisions, correct and just decisions in life, and to watch, make sure that your decisions are not based on your emotions. You know, in the case that we're talking about, it would be greed, but there are other emotions that could affect the way you make decisions. So you have to train yourself to make decisions in this area 100% correct, so that you shouldn't destroy the planet, and yet to make sure that everybody has jobs. So therefore, that takes a certain amount of wisdom to make that type of decision. Okay. The side question was asked, the question is, what is evil? I heard from Rabbi Chait like this. When your desires takes precedent over reality, that is evil. And when the mind takes precedent over your desires, then that is justice. In other words, man has a desire to do things. These things are sometimes contrary to what reality dictates. So when he gives in to these emotions, this will make you be evil. You do evil, right? When you're guided by the emotions. While on the other hand, if you're guided by the mind and you're guided by what is reality, so then you've got to get your emotions in line with the ideas. In other words, you should not give in to the emotions when the mind sees the. In other words, when you see the ideas and you don't give in to the... Let's say, for instance, you get angry and you want to hit somebody. You know it's wrong. But the mind tells you it's wrong. So you stop yourself from doing it. So therefore, the emotions are controlled by the mind. You're subservient to the mind. But however, when you don't care what truth is and what justice is, only what your desire is, so then that leads to evil. That is evil. The question is, what is disease? Disease is two things. Disease is a physical thing in the world. It has nothing to do with evil, good or evil. But, however, we see that when the human being lives a life of evil, and he doesn't live correctly in line with nature, we find that diseases are rampant. In other words, a philosopher one time said that the way you could tell an evil society is when there are two professions that keep multiplying, doctors and lawyers. And in modern times, we'll add one more profession, and that's psychiatrists. That's because the world doesn't look correctly, so because we're not living correctly, So the thing is that we've got to constantly correct things in the world. So there's a social being between people. We don't act correctly, so we need lawyers. We don't eat correctly, we don't live correctly, so we need doctors. And because we're not guided, our emotions go wild, and we need to, we are very unhappy, and we need help. So the thing is, it's because we're not guided by the mind. So therefore, sometimes disease is a natural phenomena, and even in the most perfect society, I mean, there could be a disease. But however, the rampant part of disease, that's usually because the human is not living correctly. So therefore, it's a result of his evil. But evil is always a decision on the human. It's this, the reality of the physical world. There's no good or evil in the reality of the physical world. Good or evil is based on man making his decisions.
Sure.
The question is it possible that you use the mind incorrectly? I think that is impossible unless there's an emotion that's affecting it. I mean, that seems to be the premise of Mishlei, that the whole premise of Mishlei is that it's practically it's impossible to make a mistake. I mean, unless you're not trained. I mean, there has to be a training period to think correctly. But once you go through the training period, in other words, I think all the truths that we know today, especially the simple truth, if we didn't have our emotions, everybody would see it. There'd be no problem. There'd be no problem at all. It's only because we have the emotions that affect our thinking process that we can't see the truth. But logic by itself should not make mistakes. There's a question is, how long does this training period take? The answer is, there was a man by the name of Samuel who had prophecy at 12 years old. And there's some people that might take 20, 30 years. I don't know. You know, like, it's each individual. Depends your situation. Depends on your abilities. It's a relationship between the mind, the acumen, how your IQ or the acumen of the mind, plus your emotions. Let's say you have a very good mind but bad emotions. I mean, so then to correct it, you have to correct the emotions. If you have a weak mind and good emotions, then it'll take you can only go so far. You can't go further than what your mind could take you. Let's say you have bad emotions and a weak mind. I mean, you know, it could take you 30, 40 years till you deal with the whole thing if you want to deal with it. Yeah, but I'm talking about only if you want to deal with it. So, I mean, how long it takes, that's an individual. Every individual is different based on the mind plus what type of emotions they have. The question is what is the test that you are thinking straight and acting correctly? Well, the thing is, in Mishlei, it keeps talking about that that even a king, whenever he wants to do anything, says the more advisors, the better off you are. So the only way to test is before you do an action is if you talk it over with people. People that could show you questions, not people that are nice, that just want to, you know, just say, oh yeah, whatever you do is right. But people that are willing to question you from every different angle, the more people you have that way that could question you on the situation, if you can, that would be the test when you see that how well you're doing by virtue of the questions and how off you are by the questions and how often you have to change. And by consequences, if you look back and see that you made mistakes and you get the consequences, so then you will also see, and then you try to correct these mistakes as you see your mistakes, either from others or from your own consequences, as you learn to recognize how actions are related to consequences. So once you see how actions are related to consequences, then you see consequences, you relate it back to the action, so then you're able to test yourself out that way, or with people.
That's right.
The question is, how does this relate to Satya Gaon's statement that evil is ignorance? Okay? It is true that evil is ignorance. If you don't know how to make decisions, then you will do incorrect acts, whether it is to yourself or to others. You will cause harm to yourself or to others if you're ignorant. Okay? So therefore, you must have knowledge. But the second thing is the emotions, what happens is let's say I have knowledge. Let's say I have knowledge that my parents do everything for me in every form and shape. And then one day they do something that gets me angry. At that moment, when I'm angry with them, I forget everything they did for me. I can't look at the overall picture. It doesn't allow me to look at the overall picture, but I only feel my own anger, and therefore I hate them, because I can't look at the overall picture, you see? So therefore, the emotions make you ignorant. The emotions themselves make you ignorant. So therefore, ignorance comes from two ways. In other words, one is you don't have knowledge, or two is you have knowledge, but the emotions blank it out so you can't see the truth. You see? So therefore, he really is right that that evil is ignorance. Because it comes about in two ways. To have knowledge means an overall picture of the whole picture. It's not a particular thing. Emotions only know the particular situation. They only look at the particular situation only at this moment. While knowledge takes an overall picture. I look at the past, the present, the future. I look at my parents. You know, I mean, one day they're good, one day they're bad, you know, emotionally. But if you look at the overall picture of what they did for you, I mean, you must say that they're a benefit. You understand that they did what was best for you. So the thing is that the emotions cloud. So first, knowledge trains you to look at the overall picture. But what emotions do, it closes the overall picture and makes you look only at this particular situation and closes off the whole situation, the whole picture, you see? So therefore, those are the two ways that you could be ignorant. This is chapter 10, verse 2, okay? And it says, the treasure houses of the wicked will not benefit them, and charity will save you from death. Okay, one question is what is the first half? The treasure houses will not benefit them. That's one. The other half says that charity will save you from death. What does the first half of the verse have to do with the second half? And the second question is, how does charity save you from death? I mean, where do you see that? Okay, the Rabbeinu Yonah sends us to chapter 11, verse 4, where it says, Wealth will not benefit you in the day of catastrophe, and charity will save you from death. So, first question is why they repeat it. Why they repeat it? It seems to be the same exact thing. Alright, so we want to say that in the first chapter, in chapter 10, it says it's more global, that the... That it will not benefit him at all. There is absolutely no benefit. Over here, there is a benefit, but not on. If there's a catastrophe, if there's an earthquake, so then there will not be. Then he cannot be saved. But however, seems like if you give charity, you will be saved. Okay. Also, the question is on the first verse. On the first verse, it says if you acquire your treasure through evil, what if you would give charity? The question is, would that giving of charity save you from death? Okay? What happens? How does it equal? In other words, I steal, and I become wealthy stealing, and then I give charity. Okay. The next question is, it says that the treasure houses of the wicked will not gain benefit. Question is, what does it mean it will not benefit? Is it physical benefit? They seem to have money. What is the benefit that they will be losing out? The first possibility that we want to explain is that we're talking about the comparison between this life and the next life. In this life, you might gain, but in the next life, you will... If you give charity, you will not die. It means you'll live after death, and the wicked will not continue after death. It seems that the book of Mishlei, of Proverbs, deals basically with this world and within the laws of nature, mostly. And the what Michelet is trying to prove is that the best life that the physical world has to offer is the Torah life. They'll go through, Michelet goes through every lifestyle and will show that every lifestyle is missing one of two things above. Either you will not be successful or you will not be happy. Happiness definitely cannot go, the wicked can never be happy. That they can never be. But however, success, that's why we have a question. In Judaism, they have the question, how come you see righteous people that suffer? And Nachmanides says that that is a rarity. That a righteous person will suffer is a rarity. And that it's enough that it happens to ask the contradiction about where's God's justice. You see? It's enough to ask the question on God's justice. But however, he does say it's a rarity. Okay? Most of the stories that we hear is about how righteous people, you know, die in the name of God. But we don't hear about the rest of the righteous people that have a very, very good life. You see? And they do. And that's what we have to prove. And we'll discuss it in this verse, too, to see how it works right here in this world. And we will try to see how charity will actually save you from death, literally. That's what we'll try to prove. All right, let's take the first verse that we had, that the wicked will not benefit from the treasure house, okay? Now, the thing is that this is a very universal verse, but if you go through all of Michelet, they go through all the particulars of the particulars, how it works. And basically, what happens is that people make decisions based on their emotions, okay? In other words, where your emotions are evenly keeled, in those areas you could be pretty clear and make a correct decision. But however, where you have a extreme emotion, let's say a person is extremely stingy, they might in a certain situation, let's take an extreme case, where somebody's sick, they can't afford to, even though they have the money, in their own mind they can't afford to give out that money, and therefore people could actually suffer. And if you go through each and every emotion that is an extreme, you see, you will find in the extreme case it is harmful to the person and to the people around them. Okay, and that's the details that you will go through in all of Michelet, showing the different emotions and how it affects you. While if you're evenly keeled, so then you can make a correct decision. And so therefore we see that all the great tyrants and all the great wicked people, practically all of them, failed in their lifetime. If you look through it, they really did fail. Most of them failed in their lifetime. Okay? They failed right here in the physical world, the very thing that they wanted to be successful at. They failed based on when their own emotions at a certain point took over, where there's a certain power and feeling of power and greatness. And I'm only using the tyrants, I mean it's in every area, but there's a certain feeling of power that it's close to like a god, and like whatever I do, see I'm successful, and he trusts himself, and he doesn't use the logic that he did when he first started out. That's what it means, that power corrupts. Why? Because the thing is, it affects you in a way that you cannot think the way you thought before, and that leads to decisions that will be self-destructive. Now, the first thing you'll notice, the difference between the first and the second verse, is the first verse deals with the Russia, with a wicked person. He says the treasure houses of the wicked will not benefit. The second verse does not mention evil. He says, your wealth will not benefit you on the day of catastrophe. And he doesn't mention the wicked. Okay? So based on that, the Rabbeinu Yonah wants to say that there are different levels. Okay? I'll give terms to them. He didn't put exact terms to them. I'll put my own terms. Okay? There is the wicked. Okay? There is a tzaddik. And there is a chassid. Okay? We'll define out there. Okay? A rasha, a wicked person, is a person that is totally involved only based on his emotions. Even if he thinks, he only thinks to satisfy his emotions. But the drive and the basic drive is to satisfy some emotion. Okay? Could be power, it could be wealth, could be fame, anything. And he might be intelligent in doing that. So therefore, but his basic drive, what drives him, is some extreme emotion. The tzaddik, on the other hand, is guided by laws, by a system. Let's say he learns halacha, and he keeps the system, and he's guided totally by the system of halacha. That we call a tzaddik. He's guided by the system of law given by God on Mount Sinai. And so therefore he's called a tzaddik. Okay? Chassid, the word chassid comes from the word kindness. Okay? And kindness means that I deal and understand the needs of the individual person. Okay? So what's the difference between the tzaddik and the chassid? The tzaddik is a person, let's say the Torah will tell you that you're obligated to give charity. He will give charity. You understand? If he has to say psalms for a sick person, he will say psalms for a sick person. He will say prayers for a sick person. But what he will not do is get involved with the individual. He's totally guided by the system. And then the next level is not that he uses the knowledge of the system and he tries to understand the needs of the individual that needs help, and he deals with the individual. That is what it means, charity. Tzedakah, get charity, means, in other words, see, Mishlei is not interested in not dealing with the laws. Halacha deals with exactly what you should do. Mishlei is dealing with how the laws affect you and what type of personality it develops. What happens to you is through your learning you develop a certain personality. So the first person, his personality, is simply where he gives in totally to one particular emotion and uses all his energy and if he's a thinker, he will use all his energy and thought to carry out that emotion. The second person is guided totally by a system. He's trained by the system, and he's guided by the system, and he lives by the system. You see? And that affects his personality in that he is guided by systems, science, he will think things through, you see? But what he doesn't understand and what he hasn't developed yet is a sensitivity towards other people. And that comes from an understanding of human nature and dealing with the individual person. We'll deal more with this when we discuss in a few minutes how to get to this level. We say that there is a process. In the Torah system, we have a process. And the process is that first you have to become a tzaddik, then you become a chassid. Tzaddik means where you're guided by your system and you recognize that everything, through everything, there is a system, and you're trained by the system and you're guided by the system, and it trains you to see wisdom and ideas and sciences and all the world, see the world through God's wisdom. Okay? Now, both the book of... Now, Okay, the question is what do we mean by a system? What we mean by system is a system means that all particulars are related by a certain idea, okay? And if any idea that you have about the particulars are contradicted by any particular, that would show that the idea is incorrect. In other words, particulars are connected through ideas, right? In other words, like this. If I say that you and I are equal, in other words, meaning that we're both human. Human, there's no such object as a human. There's an object you, him, I, you understand? But however, once we connect us as a unit, there's a certain idea called human beings that connect us. Now, if we would give a definition of human being, and I would show you one human being that doesn't fit that definition, so that would show that my idea that I say is connecting the human beings do not fit, are not connected. So a system means that the particulars are connected through ideas. That's what the Russia doesn't see. He only sees the particular, like he could have a system of justice where, let's say, for instance, you hold might makes right, okay? But what about if somebody else is stronger? Are you still going to hold might makes right? I mean, I doubt it. So the thing is that you understand it becomes contradictory. Their system becomes contradictory, and it doesn't matter because they only deal with the particulars, and they only use thought and ideas only to get to the particular. But they don't see it as a system that it must make sense, where you bring together all the particulars based on one idea. So therefore, the first thing a person must learn how to operate among systems to recognize that the particular is, it must, to make sense, must fit into the universals, okay? And then, once you see it that way, then you could live a correct life and think things out to understand what's correct. Okay? Now, before you can get to systems, and before you can get to becoming a chassid, one of the things you need is to train your mind how to think correctly. And there were two great books that were written especially to train your mind. One was Talmud, and one was Proverbs, Mishlei. Okay? The way it was written, it was written to train your mind. They both have benefits and they both have a little weakness in it, okay? Talmud is much, much more abstract than Proverbs. In fact, Rabbeinu Yonah says that Proverbs is the most superficial of all the sciences in Torah, all the studies in Torah, all the systems in Torah. Mishlei is the most superficial, okay? It's the least abstract. And so therefore, insofar as training the mind is concerned, Talmud is a better training, because Talmud, you could be, in other words, there are commentaries that are more abstract than any verse that you find in Proverbs. And yet Proverbs was written by the greatest genius that ever lived, according to our sages, King Solomon. So how's that possible?